Today is Monday, July 13th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, more coronavirus surges across the U.S. as the World Health Organization says nations opening too fast will continue to see new waves.
We all need to remain vigilant. We need to remain vigilant with our physical distancing, with our hygiene, with mask wearing in the appropriate setting.
Mali's opposition rejects the president's concessions aimed at ending an impasse following a weekend of deadly violence.
He has come to dialogue empty-handed without any solution to this context of the majority of the Malian people, including the unfair election.
Also ahead, the search continues for Glee TV show star Naya Rivera, believed to have drowned in a Southern California lake. It's all on today's International Edition. With more than 3 million cases and over 130,000 deaths, COVID-19 is taking a heavy toll on the United States as the number of new infections continues to rise. As VOA's Kane Farabaugh reports, encouraging people to wear masks is becoming a widespread effort now throughout the country that could help control the spread of the virus.
At Elkhart Lake, Wisconsin, fans of IndyCar racing gathered by the thousands for the first publicly accessible event since the coronavirus pandemic closed racetracks across the country. Masks were encouraged, but not mandatory.
Yeah, it's one of the best tracks in the world. So they're taking the precautions. Everyone else is taking precautions. I have no concerns about coming out.
All the staff and drivers and everybody are wearing masks, but I don't think the fans are quite as good about that.
In Florida, one of the states experiencing a surge in new COVID-19 cases, the popular Disney World Resort opened its gates to visitors for the first time in months, with a mandatory mask-wearing policy for most areas of the theme parks.
To the data we have right now, there's no downside to wearing a mask.
U.S. Assistant Secretary for Health Admiral Brett Giroir emphasized masks could prevent further spread of the virus, especially in areas where COVID-19 is on the rise.
It's really essential to wear masks. And for this to work, we have to have like 90% of people wearing a mask in public in the hotspot areas. If we don't have that, we will not get control of the virus.
After weeks of resisting, President Donald Trump wore a mask publicly for the first time while visiting service members and health care workers at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in suburban Washington, D.C.
I think when you're in a hospital, especially in that particular setting where you're talking to a lot of soldiers and people that in some cases just got off the operating tables, I think it's a great thing to wear a mask. I've never been against masks, but I do believe they have a time and a place.
In an online question and answer session from 10 Downing Street in London, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson hinted at tougher restrictions throughout Britain as new legislation in Scotland made masks mandatory in shops.
But face coverings, yes, we increasingly think that we've got to be very insistent on, you know, in places, in confined places, where you're meeting people that you don't normally come into contact with, transport, shops, wear a face covering.
Medical experts say wearing a mask isn't the only important measure that could stop the spread of infection.
You really got to stop the bars. You've got to decrease restaurant capacity. You've got to physically distance. We have to have people wearing a mask in public. It's absolutely essential. And you've got to use good hand hygiene.
Measures Admiral Giroir and other health officials across the United States hope will curb infections in the country that set records for the most new COVID-19 cases in a single day, several times over the last week. Kane Farabaugh, VOA News.
You're required to wear a face mask in the city of West Hollywood. Thank you, sir.
Florida reported a record increase of more than 15,000 new cases of COVID-19 in 24 hours Sunday. The World Health Organization reported a record increase in global coronavirus cases as well Sunday, with the total rising by more than 230,000 in 24 hours. The biggest increases were from the United States, Brazil, India, and South Africa. Dr. Mike Ryan, head of the WHO Emergencies Program, said Friday it is unlikely that the new coronavirus will be eliminated, at least for now.
And to accept the fact that in our current situation, it is very unlikely that we can eradicate or eliminate this virus. There are very particular environments in which that can occur, island states and other places, but even they risk reimportation, and we've seen countries who've managed to get to zero or almost zero reimport virus from outside. So there's always a risk, either from within or from bringing disease back in.
Meanwhile, last week, the Trump administration formally notified the United Nations that the U.S. plans to withdraw from the World Health Organization, a move widely criticized by global health experts. Many warn it's the wrong move at a time when infection rates are continuing to spike in places like the U.S., Africa, and others. One campaign, a global movement working to end extreme poverty and preventable disease by 2030, issued a statement that leaving the WHO puts the safety of all Americans and the world at risk. One campaign CEO, Gail Smith, who worked in the previous U.S. administration's Ebola response, tells VOA's Jackson Vunganyi that to end this pandemic in the U.S. and around the world, the U.S. should provide funding for a global response package to help strengthen global health systems and ensure equitable access to an eventual COVID-19 vaccine.
I think there's a huge cost to the international community because we need the WHO, again, as a body that helps coordinate, make sure information is coming in and coming out to everybody. It's a provider of assistance that many countries rely on, absolutely. It provides international guidance. And it does things other than the coronavirus. I mean, think about the effort to wipe out polio. There are a number of other things WHO does. So I think the implications are very negative, quite frankly, for the global response, but also for the United States.
During this COVID-19 global pandemic, we know one of the things that have been adversely affected has been the economies, global economies, including here the U.S. We know that lots of public health programs on the continent depend on funding coming from the U.S., from, you know, other European partner countries, and that they stock that given that these countries are already suffering themselves economically, that they're going to reduce some of their foreign aid, the funding that they give to these countries. What are some of the dangers in reducing foreign aid, especially to the public health sector?
If you look at the gains of the last 25 years in Africa, both at the macroeconomic level, but particularly in public health, to take money away from that investment to either put it exclusively into the pandemic or to save money at home is to go backwards. And the fact is the international community needs to sustain those investments in public health, as do African and other governments, while at the same time responding to the pandemic. Now, we've had a couple of good signs. The replenishment, the multi-year funding for the Global Fund for AIDS, TB, and Malaria, and the Global Vaccine Alliance both surpassed their targets. Right? So that's a good sign. I think the danger is, as you suggest, that because of the economic pressure at home, donors will start to step back. And at one level, you can understand that, but that's a very expensive proposition because part of what the fight for ending this pandemic is about is protecting the progress that's been made over the last couple of decades. And it would be real folly to let that erode.
We've had talk that the pandemic has taught us a lot about ourselves, our countries, our structures, our systems, our institutions. But in terms of global cooperation, at the height of the Ebola crisis, the attitude here in the U.S. was that this is not something that is really going to affect us. We don't really care that much up until that one case.
It did.
Us. What is it about, I guess, that time, but also this time now that showed that we should learn about, you know, global cooperation, the importance of global cooperation?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. And I think this is made very clear, as did Ebola, but this is even more stark, that we are absolutely connected globally. So in this case, none of us are going to be safe until all of us are safe. And so there's an imperative to collaborate globally because no country can exist in isolation from any other. I think that's the first. I think the second, and we've seen this at the global scale and within countries, is a crisis like this hits hardest where there are the fewest coping mechanisms and tools with which to fight back. So we are seeing among the poorest countries in the world much more damage being inflicted than among wealthier nations. And within countries, here in the United States, for example, we're seeing a totally disproportionate impact, not surprisingly, on people of color and the poor. But I think the third lesson to take away from this is we need to invest scientific capital. We need to invest resources, financial capital, but we also need to invest political capital. On the one hand, I'm finding in a lot of parts of the world there's not enough of that. I do think on the Africa side, the political capital being invested by the African Union, by President Ramaphosa, by the ECA, by a host of organizations in hanging together and fighting back, that's a good thing to watch. It's a source of hope.
Before I go, let's talk about the frustration, because I think I did want to speak on that frustration. There's a lot of frustration going around. As a person who's working in this space, yeah. What are some of your frustrations?
My frustration is that we know how to fight back against this, right? I mean, look what happened in West Africa during the Ebola epidemic. Three countries ravaged by decades of war, supported by a lot of countries, but nonetheless, they pushed back and defeated an Ebola epidemic. So certainly the world can defeat this pandemic, but I think there's a lot of misinformation. There's a lot of discounting of science and scientific fact. There's more competition for things like PPE and medical supplies than there is collaboration to make sure that enough gets to everybody quickly enough. So I guess my frustration is that this is a big, costly problem for the whole world. We know how to solve it. We're not focused on solving it the way we should be. So we're extending the life of the pandemic, and I think the suffering for everyone is affected.
One Campaign CEO Gail Smith speaking to VOA's Jackson Vunganyi. Mali's opposition on Sunday rejected concessions by President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita aimed at resolving an escalating political crisis that has sparked deadly protests, saying it would be satisfied only if he resigns. Keita announced in a speech late on Saturday he was dissolving the Constitutional Court and would move to implement recommendations made last month, which included rerunning some of the March-contested legislative elections. VOA's Peter Clotty spoke to Yesamake, a member of the opposition coalition M5-RFP, who says the president has failed to follow through on promises of implementing the recommended changes. The protests will continue until the president steps down, saying he believes lack of implementing proposed solutions to resolve the country's challenges have resulted in the loss of human life and the country's potential slide into chaos.
Dialogue is a virtue, especially in the Malian context. And Ibeka has been given plenty of opportunity to speak, especially to listen to the people of Mali. And when this situation started, a mission from CDAO came to Mali, spoke with the main stakeholders, including the president himself and the opposition groups. At the conclusion of their mission, they gave a recommendation. Among those recommendations were dissolution or the dissolving of the national parliament, which Ibeka has the constitutional right and attribution to do so. They also suggested that one of the root causes of this protest is the unfair election for parliament, and where the results of the elections are contested, they recommended that Ibeka organize partial elections in those areas. And also they recommended that he form a national unity government. All of these recommendations were left unanswered. Ibeka didn't give any sense that he approved of this recommendation, or he is willing to implement any of these recommendations. The opposition groups demanding his resignation also spoke with him and addressed a number of recommendations to resolve the crisis.
Does that mean his call for dialogue has been overtaken by events? For which reason opposition leaders are demanding his resignation?
No, he has come to dialogue empty-handed without any solution to discontent of the majority of the Malian people, including the unfair election of members of parliament in certain jurisdictions, including the district of Kati, Sikasso, and Komensenk in Bamako. He didn't come with any solution. He comes always with promise of other meetings, which confirm the position of most Malians today, that Ibecaire is not in control, that there is a shadow government that has taken our country into hostage, that Ibecaire himself, out of age and sickness, is no longer in decision-making position.
Does that mean that there is no solution in sight? Or what do you think the solution is currently to resolve this tension? Because the protesters have vowed to continue to protest until he steps down.
And they should until there is a proper response from the president. As indicated at the beginning of this dialogue, I told you that the commission of the CDAO that has come to Mali after listening to all parties have made some recommendations. And it is only after loss of lives, after clash between police force and civilians, and after his regime has killed a number of young Malians already, that he's come with a proposition or a solution trying to implement the recommendations that were offered to him 2 weeks ago. Why wait if you are ending up taking the same decision that were proposed to you a few weeks ago? So we don't understand what his thinking is. And this has been a pattern in Ibeka's decision. He has to be forced to make any decision. When he voted a law for the teachers, which Article 39 was a blocking point, it took swift protest for him to be able to declare that he's willing to implement that law.
Do you foresee the president striking a deal with the opposition leaders to ease this tension and to maintain the status quo, or that he will be forced to step down or take measures to dissolve parliament and implement the decisions that were made to him by regional leaders?
Some of those decisions made to him by regional leaders, today he was forced another appearance on TV where he declared that he has dissolved the constitutional court and that he is open to a unity government. And but he waited till things got out of hand, where there were loss of human life, to finally come to the understanding that this is not the demand of one man. This is the demand of a frustrated people of Mali. We the people. He should have heard our voices a long time ago. He has time and time again come back on decisions he's already made, including laws that he's voted. But we hope that in the light of the loss of lives, in the light of the number of people, the overwhelming masses in the street of Bamako, the historic protest against his regime, I think he'll come to understand the gravity of the situation and follow the recommendation made, but with a good faith, not just to gain some time, not just to fool the people, but for the sake of advancing our country.
Yes, Amake, a member of the opposition coalition M5RFP in Mali, speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. President Donald Trump's decision to commute the sentence of political confidant Roger Stone is drawing sharp criticism from Democrats and pointed comments from the special counsel who oversaw his prosecution. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
Roger Stone was treated very unfairly.
That's President Trump speaking to reporters at the White House Saturday. But in an op-ed in the Washington Post, former special counsel Robert Mueller recounted how, during the 2016 campaign, Stone communicated with people known to be Russian intelligence officers who had stolen Democratic emails. House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff tells ABC's This Week,
this effort to get and use foreign assistance is what Roger Stone had information on, and he lied to cover up and protect the president.
Mueller says Stone committed federal crimes and rightly remains a convicted felon. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Some years ago, UN workers assigned to assist communities in Liberia after years of conflict were found to be taking advantage of already vulnerable populations. Women and children were being sexually abused in exchange for money, jewelry, and other things of value to them. Fortunately, concerned activists saw the problem and went to work to fix it. I recently spoke to one of those people, E. Alvin Winford, program manager for the African Network for the Prevention Prevention of Child Abuse and Neglect, Liberia. He has spent the past year here in Washington, D.C. on a Fulbright scholarship, studying and working with the National Center on Sexual Exploitation. As he prepares to go back to Liberia, he plans to take what he's learned to implement even more new strategies for further stemming the tide of sexual exploitation across Liberia and the continent of Africa. Thank you for taking the time to sit down and talk. First, tell us about the work with the UN and how that all began.
In Liberia, we have had so many years of war. And to get out of that war, the United Nations really had to intervene. Coming to Liberia to rescue the vulnerable people was also a challenge. Taking into consideration that the United Nations is made of so many nations from across the globe, to curb the issue of sexual exploitation and abuse was a challenge. Actually, when they got there on the ground, in Amosha, they helped to fight the menace that we were faced with, but some of the peacekeepers were actually involved in the issue of sexual exploitation and abuse. And one thing that we could do as members of civil society was to work along with them so that they could put in preventive and response mechanism to protect the vulnerable population. And how did we do this? We worked along with the United Nations Civilian Police, conducted a series of training with them in preventing sexual exploitation and abuse. You also take into consideration that the United Nations has the Secretary General Paula at Zero Tolerance against sexual exploitation and abuse. So we use that as a working tool so that the workers of the United Nations will also be cognizant of their roles and responsibilities. And after doing such training along with them, we also work along with them so that they will work along with the new Liberian police that they have already recruited so that be instituted into their training manual. So as we speak today, the Liberian National Police has a women and child protection unit, and one of the training manuals they have actually is on preventing sexual exploitation and abuse. And that was based on our work along with the United Nations system. So what we did then was to strengthen mechanism that will prevent and respond to sexual exploitation and abuse.
And then you decided that you really want to expand on this and take this further and help more people. So you applied for a Fulbright scholarship and got it. You came to the United States and you worked with the National Center on Sexual Exploitation. How has that been for you? And what have you been doing?
I did apply for the Humphrey Fulbright Scholarship, which is supported by the United States Department of State. And I came generally to Washington, D.C. at the American University Washington College of Law to study international law and policy. But then I have to be more specific. So I decided to focus on international trafficking and prevention and policy, especially as it relates to preventing trafficking in women and children. It's a one-year fellowship that have been here. So both academic and practicum, and the academic aspect was done at American University, the practicum at the NICOSI, National Center on Sexual Exploitation and Abuse. And over the last 11 months, I have been able to learn a lot as it relates to how do you even conduct research as it relates to international trafficking. Then beyond that, how do you even address the issue of protection, prevention, and prosecution as it also relates to international trafficking. So yes, over the year, I have been able to sharpen my skills, knowledge, and experiences that I think put me in the better position now, even as I return to Liberia.
So what is your plan once you get back?
So one of the good things I'm taking back home is to be able to pilot a project on preventing that addresses the issue of the public harms of pornography. In Liberia, specifically and generally in Africa, people watch pornography. They do not really know the public harms that pornography pose to their health. And so one of the issues I've been thinking back is how then do we provide the enlightenment so that people will be able to protect themselves. And this pilot project is not only going to be for Liberia. We are piloting it in Liberia, next door Nigeria, and also in Eastern Africa, in Uganda. And the first 2 years, what we want to do is to build a network of stakeholders that will be able to provide the requisite education to women, men, and children on the basic public harms, you realize that pornography does pose public harm hazard to children. It affects the brain. It makes them not to concentrate on their academic license. It also makes them to be violent. So we want to work along with children and young people in the school, in the community, and also in religious institutions. Then we also want to target the women who are the victims in most instances, where they are perceived and to be seen as such sex objects. We want this notion to be erased so that they see themselves as human beings and they do not allow their male counterparts to continue to sexually exploit them. Then we also want to target the men. Pornography does pose public health harm to men. It makes you not to be academically astute. It makes you not to perform at work because it's affecting their brain. It makes you also addicted to other drugs, you know. Then beyond that, it also causes sexual dysfunction. And people are watching pornography. They do not know that they are also causing harm to themselves. In a nutshell, we want the African continent to realize that pornography is a drug. And being a drug, it is addicted. So all the years that have been wasted, we are now saying, look, this is not time for you to look at yourself in the mirror, unshackle yourself, take a chain, so that you will be able to protect yourself against the public harms of pornography.
E. Alvin Winford, Program Manager for the African Network for the Prevention of Child Abuse and Neglect, Liberia. Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. Hundreds of thousands of Hong Kong citizens cast ballots over the weekend in what the Chinese-ruled city's opposition camp says is a symbolic protest vote against tough new national security laws directly imposed by Beijing. The unofficial poll will decide the strongest pro-democracy candidates to contest Legislative Council elections in September when they aim to ride a wave of anti-China sentiment. Prostitutes demonstrated in Hamburg's red light district late Saturday evening, demanding that Germany's brothels be allowed to reopen after months of closure to curb spread of the coronavirus. With shops, restaurants, and bars all open again in Germany, where prostitution is legal, sex workers say they are being singled out and deprived of their livelihoods despite not posing a greater health risk. VOA's International Edition continues. Beginning Monday, July 13th, at the Oaklawn Cemetery in Tulsa, Oklahoma, the city, along with the University of Oklahoma and the Oklahoma Archaeological Survey, will conduct a test excavation as part of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre Graves Investigation. Researchers believe the site has the potential to be the location where African-American victims of that massacre, which has been called the single worst incident of racial violence in American history. The test site was chosen based on oral histories passed down and results from ground-penetrating radar. International Edition Steve Miller spoke with Scott Ellsworth, a professor in the Department of Afro-American and African Studies at the University of Michigan and who happens to be part of the Dig team.
So what we'll do is we're gonna take a small area in the middle, about 6 feet by 8 feet. We're gonna excavate down first using a backhoe for the first few feet, and then by hand. And we're gonna go down and see if this anomaly number one is indeed human remains or not. Then we'll see what condition they're in. I mean, there could be they could be in great condition. They could be in very poor condition. And then we will see if we can determine whether these human remains are indeed related to the race massacre, whether we have a high degree of confidence that they are. So that is really the goal, you know, coming up here right now. If we do find remains and we are convinced or feel fairly solidly that these are race massacre remains, we will then go ahead and stop at that point. We will cover up the hole and then await approval for the next step.
How big a team are we talking in terms of carrying out this investigation?
Well, that's a great question. And that is, you know, we had originally planned to do this in April, right before the pandemic hit. So our team is smaller, but it's still pretty good size. I would imagine there'll be a dozen of us off and on over the course of the excavation that's within the enclosed area.
And that was one of the things I wanted to ask you about. I mean, Oklahoma has seen a surge in cases as of late. So while you have a smaller number of people participating in the dig, What other precautions are you taking?
Well, quite a few, actually. So I'll be arriving, you know, back home in Tulsa on Sunday night. And the first thing that'll happen when I check into the hotel is that I will be tested for COVID by a member of the Tulsa Fire Department. We will all wear protective gear, PPE. We'll all follow, you know, safe distancing guidelines, all of that.
And the search continues for former Glee star Naya Rivera, who is presumed to have drowned while boating on a lake near Los Angeles. No body so far has been found. The 33-year-old who played high school cheerleader Santana Lopez in the television series until 2015 went missing on Wednesday of last week after renting a boat on Lake Piru with her 4-year-old son, Josie. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Wundanyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day.